Our lesson for this morning, as we continue on in the Gospel of Luke, is not exactly what's printed in your bulletin. I made a little bit of an abbreviation as I was working on the sermon. I realized that there was just too much good material there to run through in 1 week. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to read the opening verses of this. And I'll save most of the rest of the passage to the end of chapter 11 for next week, because I want to take my time with that. I don't want to adopt Jesus' attitude, which is one of criticism, which we don't hear a lot from Jesus, but when we do, it's very pointed. I am not worthy to criticize as he is. But there are important truths in that criticism that I think I need to hear, and that's why I share them with you. And that's something that I did want to say. I don't get a chance to say this real often. I used to say this at the White Deer Parish, because back there, a lot of my sermons weren't always really well received, especially at St. John's. Talking about my main thrust has always been appreciating what Christ has done for us and then living a life that reflects his teaching and his life. And as I used to say then, so I say today, that when I preach, my primary audience, I've had people say, you know, you were preaching that right at me and I didn't appreciate it, you know. My primary audience when I preach is myself, and it's one reason I'm taking my time with what my Bible titles the six woes of the Pharisees, because there are lessons there I need to hear, and I want to take time and make sure I hear them. And one way of me hearing them is me talking about them to you. So you know how some people, they wrestle with the decision they have to make, and so they talk to you, and what they're really doing is they're getting it out and they're listening to themselves talk. And if you're smart, what you'll do is you'll nod your head or shake your head and, oh, really? Oh, is that so? You know. And then when they're done, they actually will have counseled themselves, because all they needed was to hear what they were thinking, and as they could hear it, then they could process it. And sometimes that's what I do in my messages. I speak to you as a way of speaking to myself, and I'm doing that this morning as well. So let's take a look at the lesson, Luke chapter 11, verses 37. To 40. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So Jesus went, and he dined with him, reclining at his table. But the Pharisee was surprised, for he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. How foolish of you! Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also?" I'm going to stop there for now. And like I say, I'll deal with the rest of this passage next week. I want you to put yourself in Jesus' sandals. I guess he didn't wear shoes. Put yourself in Jesus' place here. We've reached almost the end of the 11th chapter of Luke. Jesus has been in active ministry ever since the 4th chapter. And so that's what? Almost eight full chapters of ministry. Jesus has been traveling back and forth. He's been healing. He's been teaching. He's been praying. And through all this time, he's been gaining a reputation. He's been gaining an audience. In fact, There have been times when he wanted to go off into a secluded area and pray, and the disciples would come to him and say, "Master, they're calling for you." And he would have to interrupt his prayer time in order to attend to the people. He usually didn't mind that. He would say to his disciples, "Well, we must move on to the next city, and then the next one, and the next one, because that's one reason why I came, to spread the good news." And here he has what we've been told, 72 disciples that he sent out two by two. And either of those 72, or in addition to those 72, there are 12 in particular that he called apostles, who had a special relationship with him. And of those 12, there were three that had a unique relationship with him, Peter and James and John. And of those three, it seems, Peter is the most prominent. So you might say Jesus is surrounded by friends. If he were on Facebook today, and I imagine he is, because everybody is on Facebook today except me, then he would have countless, he'd have more friends than Donald Trump. And that's just the kind of friends he would have. Someone who sees something he says, or hears about something he did, says, "I like that," and hits the like button and says, "Friend request. I want to be a friend." And here in the United States, that's all you have to do to be somebody's friend. One reason I got off of Facebook is because I only had 56 friends. Tammy had 59 at the time. Now she's got more than that. That's all you have to do to be a friend. Click a button. So convenient. In fact, there was a study done. Oh, there's always a study done. At our expense, most of them, because they're done with government grants. But there was a study done. Somebody went to different Middle Eastern exchange students. How's that for a select group of people? And they asked them, "What's your impression of Americans, particularly of American students?" I should have asked Greg that when he came with Cammie and her family to get his picture taken. "What's your impression of American students? What's it like to be a student in an American school coming from a different culture?" And it was interesting. One of the things they mentioned I found really interesting. They said, "You know, you Americans," I love it when they say, "You Americans. You Americans are very friendly. You are the friendliest people I have ever known." Can you hear it? But you make lousy friends. And I think that pretty much sums up our culture. We're very friendly, but we make lousy friends. Because all it takes to be a friend is a click of the mouse. And boy, don't you feel good about yourself. So here's Jesus. He's got thousands of friends. And everywhere he goes, they come out. And some of them will be sure and go up to talk to him, either before or after his message. "Jesus, I've got to tell you how much you helped me. Jesus, it was wonderful when you healed my brother, my sister, my friend, my cousin. Jesus, you're the best." I wonder if Jesus felt the same way about Middle Eastern crowds as the Middle Easterners felt about our society. You know, you're very friendly people. up until the end of this chapter anyway, you're very friendly people. But you make lousy friends. Here is Jesus. After a speaking engagement, if you've ever had a speaking engagement, or if you've ever had anything that you had to do, something for work or something for your family, Christmas dinner, getting all those 40 different kinds of Christmas cookies made, buying presents for everyone in the family. I talked to someone the other day after Christmas. Was really suffering. Because she had gone to all this trouble to make everybody's Christmas special. And nobody even so much as sent her a card, let alone a gift. And here is Jesus. He has just finished pouring himself out in front of the crowd through healing and through teaching. For most of the crowd, it's just another occasion. Isn't it wonderful? Wonder where he's going next. Check that guy's t-shirt, because on the back of his t-shirt, he lists all the places where Jesus is going to appear. You know, I don't think they did that back then, but they do that now. When bands go on concert tours, here's where they're going to be. And the dates. Makes it convenient. Don't even need a smartphone for that. Just look at someone's t-shirt. And it's all over. Jesus is ready to head back to wherever he goes, because he doesn't have a home of his own. And a fellow comes up to him in the crowd and he says, "Jesus, what are you doing now that you're done speaking?" And Jesus says, "Well, I'm going to go back with my disciples. How would you like to come to my house for dinner?" That would be wonderful. Imagine how Jesus must have felt. Finally, someone wants to really understand what I'm saying. Sort of like Nicodemus the other night when Matthew was reading about him coming at night. Here's someone who's going out of his way because something in his heart has been touched by what I've said or done. And he's offering an opportunity for a deeper relationship. Not just a like and a friend request, but actual time. Oh, one of the most precious gifts of all, time. He wants to sit down with me. He wants us to communicate. Because in the Middle East, when you had a meal, that's what you did. You reclined at the table. You took your time. You didn't do what I do after a meal, get up and take everybody's dishes and go over to the sink and wash the dishes. I don't know. It's just a habit of mine. No, you sit there, let the dishes go. Well, clean them up tomorrow morning. The mice can feast tonight when we go to bed. I wonder if Jesus wasn't really looking forward to this. We know he does. In Revelation, he tells the church at Laodicea, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. And if you open the door, I will come in. And I will dine with you, and you with me." Not just eat, not just grab a bite, but go to Starbucks and sit down with a cup of coffee, a latte, or in my case, a hot chocolate. Except I might go to Dunkin' Donuts instead. I haven't decided. I've tried them both. The jury's out on that one. Jesus is thinking, We can dine together. Just a small company of people. Not thousands and thousands. Just Just a small company. And in that small company, maybe for a moment or two, it'll even be just him and me. Sharing our hearts with each other. Won't it be grand? And what happens? He didn't wash before eating. Maybe it was a mistake to invite him to meal. You ever hear the song Cats in the Cradle? That song was playing on the radio when Matthew was born. Cats in the Cradle. Yeah, he don't remember. But I do. Sometimes it comes back to haunt me. It's a song about a father whose wife has a baby. But he's not there. Good thing. Doesn't hear his wife say, "You're responsible for this." No, he's off making a living. Because that's what a good father does. And it follows that son through his childhood and the many opportunities when the son says to the father, "Hey, now can we play? Now can we spend some time together?" No. Father is busy. Father is working. Father is making a living. Father is doing what good fathers do. Father is doing what's right and decent and proper and good. Later on, when the father retires, he finally has some time. So what does he do? He calls up the son and says, "Hey son, now I've got some time. Want to play ball? Want to sit and talk?" Son says, "Sorry, Dad, I can't. I'm making a living for my family. I'm doing what's decent and right and good and proper." And the saddest thing about that song for me is that the fact that the son learned the lesson of the father. He learned what really matters. What really matters is not who he is. It's what he does. After all, what he does, he's doing for those he loves. The lesson he learned as a child, and it was a lesson learned in tears, I'm sure, is that it's not right to dwell on ourselves. It's selfish to take time away from your responsibilities just to be in each other's company. There's too much to be done, and the work proves your worth. I want you to look at that song, that poem, as an illustration of today's lesson. But I don't want you to get the wrong idea. Don't look at the Father and say, "That's Jesus," or "That's God." Maybe we feel that way sometimes. "God, can we talk? I'm talking, God, but I don't feel like you're there." "Oh, I know. You have so many things to take care of. You don't really have time for my concerns. So I won't bother you with my needs, Father, unless they're really big. Maybe if the doctor says I have cancer, then I'll talk to you. If I lose my job, then I'll talk to you. But day to day, I can manage the day to day, so I'm okay, Lord. You just take care of your own business." No, that's not the message of this song. Jesus is not the Father too busy for the Son. He is not the Father wanting a relationship with his Son when it's too late. He is not the Son longing for a relationship with his Father Jesus is the relationship, the opportunity for a connection that goes deeper than the surface. Jesus is the opportunity for relationship, and in that song, as in the Gospels, he is ignored because other things are more important. And it's been that way ever since the fourth chapter of Luke. People are fascinated with the miracles he performs. He's a miracle worker. But when he goes to speak, they lose interest and they yawn. His sermons are too long. They just don't move me. Even the disciples, they get caught up in the authority that Jesus hands to them and says, "Here, you go out and heal the sick and cast out demons and raise the dead." And they do. And they get the same reaction as Jesus. But they don't mind because they're drunk with the power. It feels so good. And it must. I've wanted to know how it feels to pray for someone's healing and have them healed and think for just a moment, it was because of my prayer. But it doesn't work that way with me. Most of the prayers I pray for and have prayed for years have not been answered that spectacularly. The only time that I can point to right now where prayers were answered in a spectacular way were your prayers for me when I was in the hospital. But at that time, I couldn't really pray for my healing. All I could pray for was that God would be with me. And he was. But it was your prayers for my healing that led to the day when I stood before Peter Bradford. You know, Peter was here one Sunday when I was not. And he stopped at the house. I was at home at that time, and Tammy's giving me infusions of antibiotic. And there was a look on his face that at the time I didn't notice, but as I thought back on it, I realized he doesn't think I'm going to make it. And I saw him several months later. And it took him a moment as I explained to him who I was. "You were to visit me and my family in West Milton." "It's Lazarus raised from the dead," he says. "I know what that feels like. To be on the receiving end, I don't quite know how it feels like to be the one who said, 'Lazarus, come forth.'" But the disciples did. They could say that. They could do that. They could lay their hands on someone and he was healed of physical distress, of handicap, of mental anguish. He could do that. And the disciples could do that. And when they did it, they liked it. And they came back and they told Jesus. They said, "Hey, it was great. Even the demons listened to us." And Jesus is like, "No, my own disciples." "That's well and good," he said. "But don't rejoice that the demons listen to you. Rejoice in this." Do you remember what? "Your names are written in heaven." Everything here, the healings, the diseases, the trials, the joys, everything here, it'll be gone. Don't you wish for the last 20 years, maybe you do this, We used to do it and then kind of got away from it. Don't you wish at the end of every year you'd write a Christmas letter to everyone, tell them what happened during that year. And then 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, you have copies of all those letters and you have like a diary, what happened year after year after year. And you look at it, you tell yourself, oh, I forgot about that. Or, oh, really? Was that that year? Things that right now are everything to us. And 20 years from now, we're like, I don't even remember that happening. But there's one thing that doesn't go away. Relationship. It's where Jesus is in Cats in the Cradle. The opportunity for relationship. Do you ever notice when you're with someone that you've been with a lot before, but something's different? You don't know what it is. You don't know how it happened. It just happened. You're with them on an occasion and you come away from it and say, wow, I have never had an experience like that. We actually connected. We don't even know what words to use. We didn't try. It just happened. And it, wow. Maybe that's what life is all about. Remember Mary and Martha? Mary understood. She sat at Jesus' feet. Martha said, she's just sitting there because she knows she can get out of work. And maybe that was true. But maybe not. Maybe she just wanted to hear what Jesus had to say. Because there's something about, is it his words? Is it his voice? There's something about Jesus that I just can't get enough of him. But Martha, Martha, Martha. Every time I read that passage in Luke, I think of my mom. Because that's her name. Martha, Martha. But to me, if there was a Martha and a Mary, she should have been named Mary. And there were others that could have been named Martha. You're so busy doing so many things. And they are all, what did I say about the Cats in the Cradle? They are all decent, right, proper, good. But only one thing is needed. Mary has made a good choice. And I won't take it from her. She has chosen wisely. As the knight said in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I don't know how many of you saw that movie. All these holy grails, and you have to pick the right one, because if you pick the wrong one, it'll kill you. And the knight says, choose wisely. And one guy grabs one that's the most beautiful, gilded, it's gold, it's beautiful, and he drinks from it and he dies. And the knight just looks at him and says, he chose poorly. Then Indiana Jones takes one and he drinks from it and he lives. And the knight says, you have chosen wisely. There's another scene from that movie that comes to my mind. It's a part of the movie where Indiana Jones is trying to rescue his father. His father's in a tank. Somehow his father manages to get out, and Indy's on the tank. And the tank goes over a cliff, and his father watches it go. And he and his friends are standing at the top of the cliff, convinced that Indy went to his death. One of them's like this, as if praying will bring him back. His father takes off his hat. It can't be. There's so much I wanted to say to him. And now it's too late. What they don't know is that Indy jumped off the tank before it went over the cliff, and he's clinging to the side of the cliff, and he climbs up, and he's all beat up, and his clothes are a mess, and he's standing behind them, and he's looking over the cliff with them, and he's like, yeah, that was really something, you know. And his father feels the movement, and he turns around and looks up, and there's the sun. The son that he thought was gone, and he never had a chance to talk to him. So what does he do? He hugs him. Boy, I thought it was too late. My boy. He's speaking to him as if he's a child again. And Indy, there's a look on his face like, finally, after all these years, my father is embracing me. And maybe he's going to talk to me. But then his father recovers himself and they separate. He goes like this. He says, well, we've got work to do. And he picks up his hat, walks off, and leaves Indy to fall on the dirt. Come on, boy, what are you waiting for? We've got work to do. And the moment's gone. The opportunity for relationship is gone. Jesus is left alone as they all head off to their next adventure. Last week, Jesus tried to tell us what was really important. As he addressed those people who were so fascinated with his miracles but didn't listen to his preaching, he said, if the miracles I did in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon and Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities would have remained to this day. The people would have repented. They would have got the message. You didn't get the message. You were too fascinated with the special effects. Last week he said, the Queen of Sheba came all the way from the kingdom in the south because she heard about Solomon. She came and she praised him and she lavished gifts on him. Well, let me tell you something. There's someone greater than Solomon here. And all you can do, nice work, Jesus, let's see it again. When the miracle doesn't happen again, we know what's going to happen. Crucify. Crucify. That's what Herod did. He was hoping to see a miracle, and when Jesus didn't do a miracle, he sent him back to Pilate. Yeah, nothing special about this guy. Do another miracle. It's like that opera about Moses and the Exodus that was written by a... You have to excuse me, I just don't know what to say. Should I say a black, an African-American, colored person? Someone whose ancestors were slaves, I'll put it that way. They wrote an opera about the Exodus. And there was one line in it where God says to Moses, after he sent the manna and the quail, he says to Moses, says, oh, the people are complaining about, and he says, you know the problem with this people, you do one miracle for them, then you have to do seven more just to keep up. And that's what happens for people who are fascinated with the miracles. Or even reading books about other Christians and how they're miraculously transformed by believing in Jesus. And we get caught up in that sense of the miraculous and we fail to realize what's really a miracle is that wherever I am, I can address God and pour my heart out to him and know that he is there. Because that opportunity for relationship, that's with me all the time. That's the point. It never goes away. Some moments are more opportune than others, but there's always a possibility of turning this moment into that opportunity. So Jesus says, here's one group of people, they hear the message and they don't repent, so they're lost. Here's another group of people, they hear the miracles, they see the miracles, they hear the preaching, but there's no praise. There's no corresponding response to God of, this guy is something, and his words are life to me. Just going from one high to another. Ain't life wonderful? Nothing but diversion on the one hand, and as we see later in today's episode, criticism on the other. We see it right now. He didn't wash his hands. Maybe it was a mistake to invite him to dinner. He's not concerned about the spreading of germs. He's not afraid that Jesus has been out and he's in the dust and all of this, shaking hands with people. Oh my goodness. And his hands are dirty and we're going to get sick. No, it wasn't sickness he was concerned about. It was moral impurity. You must wash all the way up to the elbows. It's a ceremonial thing. Jesus didn't do that, so he's ceremonially unclean. You know what that means? Everything he touches becomes ceremonially unclean. And when you have a meal in the Middle East, everybody touches everything. Here is the bread. Oh, I'll have a piece. Here, you have a piece. Take a piece of bread from a loaf that you just had your hands on. Oh, we're much more sanitary here. Here's the plate with the bread on it. Take the fork and take the bread off. Over there, it's like grab here, grab there. Everyone's touching. He touches that food, all the food becomes unclean. Maybe this was a mistake. And Jesus is like, well, there goes any expectation I had of a heart-to-heart. Not much chance for that. And Jesus has finally had enough. You mean to tell me you went to all the trouble of fixing a dinner and inviting me to dine with you, and all you care about is whether I've ceremonially washed myself? You wash the outside. What about the inside? God doesn't meet with you here, shake my hand, I'm God. God meets with you here. Now, how clean is that? Only God can make it clean. But he can't make it clean if you remain shut off from him. God is like a nosy neighbor. We used to have these up on 7th Street because at the time we lived in a parsonage. And you know, the parsonage is like the White House. It belongs to the people. And we had some people who believed that. And so they would come, they'd knock on the door, and they'd just come in. Hey, how's my house doing, you know? Well, you know, Jesus is like that. When he knocks on the door of our heart, and we let him in, and he dines with us, he's kind of snoopy. Oh, here's a stack of me. Who are you getting mail from? Oh, there's some books. What are you reading? What kind of books are you reading? Oh, there's all the videotapes and the DVDs that you've been making of your favorite TV. What are your favorite TV shows? I'd like to know. Well, you know, nosy neighbors have no right to know, but God does. And that's why we say thanks, but no thanks. That's why the Pharisee is more concerned with him washing than with him actually sitting down at the meal and talking. Because what if he says something that touches a place in me that's not what it should be? Or what if he touches a place in me, like the song, Cats in a Cradle, kind of a sore place that reminds me of my failures with other people, that reminds me of opportunities lost that can never come back again? I'm not sure I want to get that close to Jesus. On the other hand, when you listen to what Jesus says, don't rejoice in this, but rejoice in this, that your names are written in heaven. Brings to mind, and I'll close with this. I always say that to let you know the end is in sight. Psalm 116, verses 12 and 13. What shall I render to the Lord for all his benefits to me? You can't say that verse unless first you recognize that God has benefited you in some way. But once you realize what God has done, once you realize that God came to us and he accepted us in all of our filth and all of our uncleanness, he accepted us, and it's through him that we are healed. What can I render to the Lord for all his benefits to me? What can I pay him, you know? In the bleak midwinter, if I were a shepherd, I would give a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. What can I give him? The psalm says, I will take up the cup. Well, this isn't really a cup, but you get the message. I take up the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. What else can you do? What does that mean in my life? What does that mean? To lift up the cup of salvation is to do what Jesus said to the disciples. Rejoice in this, that your names are written in heaven. That's salvation. It's a salvation that guarantees all the other salvations in life we need. And what does it mean to call upon the name of the Lord? When do people call upon the name of the Lord? People call upon the name of the Lord when they need something. People call upon the name of the Lord. That's what calling on the name of the Lord means. Lord, I'm in distress, help me. What can we do when we realize all that God has done for us? Well, we can be thankful for our salvation and we can open ourselves up to God and say, let's sit down and talk. Because I need the insight that only your Spirit can bring. And I need the healing that only you understand. And I just need to know that you understand my pain. And Jesus says, finally, finally, let's eat. I'd like to close with a prayer that I have in a book that I got last year for Christmas. It's a collection of Puritan prayers, and I got a new appreciation for the Puritans by reading some of these prayers. This one is labeled The End of the Year, and I felt it was a good prayer to end not only my sermon with, but our year of worship. O love beyond compare, you are good when you give, you are good when you take away. You are good when the sun shines, you are good when the night gathers. You have loved me from the foundation of the world. And in love, you redeemed my soul. You love me still, in spite of my hard heart, my ingratitude, my distrust of you. Your goodness has been with me through another year, leading me through a twisting wilderness, in retreat, helping me to advance, when beaten back, still making headway. Your goodness will be with me in the year ahead. I hoist sail and draw up anchor with you as the blessed pilot of my future, as you have been of my past. I bless you that you have veiled my eyes from the waters ahead. If you have appointed storms of trouble, you will be with me in them. If I must pass through tempests of persecution and temptation, I will not drown. If I am to die, I will see your face all the sooner. If pain is to be my lot, grant me grace that my faith not fail. Only glorify yourself in me, whether in comfort or in trial, as a chosen vessel, always suitable for your use. Amen.